Listen again to Jesus' words to you. You are the light of the world. This world is dark. This world needs light. Jesus is the light of the world. And when we walk in his steps, we reflect his light into the darkness of this world. And no matter how bleak or how terrifying in its magnitude that darkness is, it cannot overcome the light that reflects off of us from him. Amen. Tonight, together we will look at a very dark moment in the life of Jesus. And we will see that in this dark moment he faces, that he makes a choice, and that his choice issues some light into the darkness, which is dark, but which cannot overcome that light. And if we together, as individuals and as a whole church, would let the light that comes off of him in this moment actually fall upon our eyes, rather than blocking it, I believe that it could transform us individually and as a group, so that when we leave this place tonight, we go into the world that is dark, and we bear some of the light of Christ into the world. And that is my aim in sharing with you tonight. What we will look at together as we proceed in this series that we've been undertaking together, from Gethsemane, the garden in which Jesus prayed, to Golgotha, what we will see tonight is the next in this installment, our seventh week. And what we'll look at tonight is Jesus as he stands before a group of soldiers. I want you to grab your Bible now and open up to Matthew chapter 27. Jesus has just been officially condemned to death by the Roman governor Pilate. He had been standing before a crowd that shouted for his crucifixion and his death. Pilate turned him over to this sentence of death. And then he is taken by a group of soldiers, of Roman soldiers, and they take Jesus from off of that stage in front of all of those people, and they bring him inside of inside of Pilate's palace, into the back room, and they're there with him. And that's what I want to look at with you. Find verse 27 in Matthew chapter 27. And I want you to read along with me. Then the soldiers of the governor took Jesus into the governor's headquarters, and they gathered the whole cohort around him. They stripped him and put a scarlet robe on him, and after twisting some thorns into a crown, they put it on his head. They put a reed in his right hand and knelt before him and mocked him, saying, "Hail, King of the Jews!" They spat on him and took the reed and struck him on the head. After mocking him, they stripped him of the robe and put his own clothes on him, and then they led him away to crucify him. Before we talk about the details of this moment, I wonder if you, like me, had always thought that the worst thing that Jesus went through in these last days was when he was crucified and nailed to that cross. I always had the impression that the moment that was the hardest and the most awful must have been when he was physically nailed to that tree. And if you've seen any movie that depicts these last hours of Jesus' life, chances are you will also see that that was the moment that got most attention. The actual physical murder of Christ on the cross. If we look at Matthew, and if we try to make a judgment about what was the worst thing he went through, do you know what happens when we come to the moment when he's actually nailed to the cross? In this narrative, we don't hear one thing about how they did it. The author doesn't spend even a single moment telling us what Jesus was feeling emotionally or what he was going through physically. There's no description of how he was crucified at all. In fact, when we come to the point in this narrative where Matthew finally tells us about the murder of Jesus, I want you to look at verse 35, because that's where it happens. In English, it takes five words, "and when they had crucified him," and that's it. In Greek, it's only three words. Only three words are given to the moment when he's actually murdered and killed on the cross. But then, before it, there's all of these details about an interchange between him and a group of soldiers. What does this tell us? It tells us something that each one of us know deep down inside, and that is this. That as bad as physical pain and torment can be, emotional and spiritual suffering is worse. That while, no doubt, the torture and the suffering that Jesus went through when he was killed on the cross, while no doubt that was awful, it tells us that the things that he went through before getting to the cross, the things that he suffered with the people that we meet from Gethsemane to Golgotha, the things that hurt his heart were worse by far. Now, is there anyone in here who wouldn't agree that there is something uniquely painful about the emotional cruelty that people can give to each other? I want to look with you specifically at the details that Matthew chooses to give us here, because in these verses that we read, in verses 27 to 31, there are three dramatic elements that he puts in this scene that tell us exactly what's going on with the soldiers. And I have a fantastic painting that I want you to look at as I describe these to you. This is, if you've been here earlier in this series, you know that I've gone repeatedly, Jared, if you get the lights, to an Italian Renaissance painter who I've called Caravaggio, who painted in the very early part of the 17th century. This is one of his students, and it's a man called Van Hanthorst, and he was Dutch. And for some reason, it's not coming through in color, which is sad because it's quite a beautiful picture. But in this painting here, this Dutch painter captures the details of the scene that we've just read about in a very effective way. The three elements that he listed there, Matthew, are the robe, the crown, and the reed. Now, I want you to look carefully at that painting there. And I want you to notice, first of all, that on the right side, there's a man who holds behind Jesus' back a robe. The robe that Matthew tells us about is a scarlet robe. The scarlet robe is the military garb that a traditional Roman soldier would have worn. In the ancient world, even more so than today, physical appearance, and especially the clothing, was assigned to everybody about what your status was as a person. And anyone in Jesus' day who wore a scarlet robe would have immediately communicated to everyone around them that they were a part of the military machine that was Rome. And so, this robe here that this man puts on Jesus signifies to anyone who would look strength and might. That's the first image in there. The second is the crown. Woven out of thorns, these men put atop Jesus' head a crown. The crown signified royalty. And anyone who saw the person with the crown would know right away that that individual deserved two things from all people: respect and honor. Because the crown signified dignity, the dignity that came to a king. And the one who wore it would be higher than anyone else around. And so that is the second element we have there on Jesus. It's the crown. The third is the reed that this man here puts in his hand. The reed in this scene signifies the mock scepter. The scepter in the ancient Egyptian writing system was the word. You know how Egyptian is got symbols. It was the word for rule. Because just as the crown signified the dignity and honor of the king, the scepter was the visible symbol that the king held in his hand that showed everybody that he had authority and power. And so the person who had the scepter in his hand was the one who was in charge. It symbolized to all who would see authority and power. That is why in the ancient world, if one king conquered another kingdom, the first thing he would do after conquering the kingdom was to take the royal scepter and shatter it, showing that he had prevailed over the king. Now, I want you to see one more element in this scene, because this is where this artist, Van Hanthorst, truly captures what's happening in this text that we've just read. Can you make out the facial expression of the man kneeling in front of Jesus? Do you see what he's doing? He's laughing. He's laughing because he and all the other soldiers, when they look at Jesus, they do not see strength and power. What they see is weakness and frailty. And so they get a robe out and put it on him to make fun of him for being so weak. When they stand before Jesus, they do not see someone who should be respected and treated with dignity. They see someone who's shameful and a disgrace. And so they bring out a fake crown and put it on his head to make fun of this would-be king as their laughter fills the room. And then when they see Jesus, they don't see somebody with power or authority. They see someone who's been undone by the strength of Rome, who's weak and pitiful. And so they put the scepter in his hand to make the picture complete, and they go on laughing at him right there. A cohort of soldiers is 600 soldiers. And so in this scene, we have Jesus in the back room, surrounded by a circle of 600 soldiers who have swords and clubs and armor to protect them. And he, right in the middle, a defenseless man with no weapons, kneeling down and his hands are bowed. And they laugh at him. And then Matthew tells us they take the staff from his hand and they hit him in the head with it. And they spit on him. And they kneel down in mock submission. And they chant with gleeful sarcasm, "Hail, King of the Jews." This scene pictures a group of men who, before they pass this no-name criminal onto his death, have decided to have some fun with him. And so they make sport of him as they mock him and laugh at him. This scene, it has something to teach us. Jared, would you grab the lights? Is there anyone in here who doesn't know the pain that comes from becoming the object of human cruelty? Don't you know what it's like when someone mocks you and insults you and disrespects you? Doesn't that hurt? Don't you know how that goes all the way to your heart? Maybe when you were in junior high, you were awkward. And the kids made fun of you. And to this day, you're insecure about your body. Maybe you travel with a group of friends who are particularly gifted at sarcasm. And there's something about you that makes it so that you're always the butt of their humor. And it hurts you more than you let on. Maybe in your family, when there are gatherings together at holidays, there's that one person who always slights you in front of everyone else. And you become the subject of a raucous a crowd of laughter. Or maybe there's someone at work who's always cruel to you. Or there are friends who are rotten behind your back. And you know what it's like to suffer the misery of being abused and mocked, insulted and disrespected. Do you know what that's like? Yes? This is the question. How do you respond? I'll tell you, the way we answer this question will make it so that we are either more darkness in this world or a little light in this world. How do you respond when you become the subject of abuse like this? Let me ask you this. Do you feel the instinctive surge for revenge? Do you? Do you know what it's like when inside of your heart there's all of a sudden this flood of emotions? It's like a riverbank overflowing and just spilling out all over in anger. And you are immediately, without even thinking, scheming and looking for a way to get back at that person. You have been hurt by someone, and without even planning it in your mind, already you're figuring out a way to give that hurt back to them. Yes? Do other people do this? You go to bed at night thinking about how you could get back, how you could hurt that individual, how you could get some revenge on that person that hurt you. Yes? I think that it is a universal human phenomenon that when we're injured, we look for ways to get back at the people who hurt us. Do you know what? I believe, I was thinking about this week, I believe I have incontrovertible evidence that this is true, and here it is. Every sitcom ever made has at least one episode in which the plot is as follows. Main character is hurt at the beginning of the show. The entire plot of the show is that character scheming at how to get back at the person that hurt them. Yes? You know what I mean? Did any of you watch sitcoms? How about this? I'm going to give you an example. George Costanza. Jerk Store. I can tell by the laughter that some of you know the episode. For those of you who don't, let me explain. Seinfeld, it's a popular show when, in the 80s and 90s? 90s and, I don't know. It was a popular show a while ago. One of the characters is George Costanza, short, balding, fat guy. And he's always having problems. And in one of these episodes, here's how the scene begins. George is sitting at a conference table. He works for the Yankees. And the discussion is whether to put in a new Jumbotron vision. Some of you know this episode. If you know it, would you help me out here? Yes? He makes some suggestion about putting this thing here or there. And as he's making the suggestion, the camera shows that George is sitting at this table with a bucket of shrimp. And he's got some shrimp cocktail there. And he's shoveling the shrimp into his mouth during the meeting. He's eating. And as the camera flashes to him and he speaks up, he looks like a chipmunk because he's got so many shrimp in his mouth and he's continuing to put them in there while he makes a suggestion. I think we put the shrimp in the paddle box. And then the camera cuts to the man sitting across from George. The man looks at him, leans forward, and he says, "Hey, George, the ocean called. They're running out of shrimp." The camera cuts to the rest of the meeting. Everybody is uproariously laughing. And then it cuts back to George with his cheeks stuffed full of shrimp. And another one is, and he looks hurt. He's really hurt. Next scene. Cuts to him in his car. As he's driving along, he's repeating over and over to himself the insult that he just received. They're running out of shrimp. They're running out of shrimp. He's really mad. And then, all of a sudden, you see this idea come into his head. His eyes light up and he says, "Oh, yes! That's what I should have said!" Cuts to him with his friend Jerry, and he's explaining to his friend Jerry what happened. "Jerry, I was at this meeting. The guy said the ocean called. They're running out of shrimp." And then this is what George says to his friend Jerry. "Then, get this. I looked at him and I said, 'Oh, yeah? The jerk store called, and they're running out of you!'" Jerry doesn't think it's very funny. He kind of forces a laugh. And he says, "Really? You said that?" And then George says, "Well, no, I thought about saying it." And Jerry says, "Well, that's not the same thing." That's just the opening part of the episode. The entire rest of the episode is George trying to figure out a way to make this happen where he can get the guy to do that insult again, and then he can use the jerk store line. That's the entire episode. Now, listen, it's a goofy episode, and I love it, but life is like that for a lot of us. I don't know about you. I'll tell you, for me, this is a confession to you. Recently even, and some of my friends who are in here know this, I've been hurt. And I have used energy, lots of energy, for weeks and months even, thinking about how to retaliate. My life is not a sitcom. Now George, he arranges another meeting at work, and he brings even more shrimp this time. And he's put even more in his mouth, and he's sitting across from where Riley, the guy at work, is supposed to be, but it turns out his plan backfires because Riley has been transferred to another company. He now works for Firestone. So what does George do? He finds out the guy works in Akron, Ohio, and he flies out to Akron and gets in the meeting so that he can use his insult. Now, it's the third time we see him here. He's got the largest bowl of shrimp we've seen him with yet. He's got more in his mouth than last time. And there's Riley sitting across from him. And this time, Riley does it again. He uses the same line because it's a new crowd, right? Everybody's laughing, but now the camera cuts to George, and he's got this look on his face of triumph. "I got it." He stands up with the shrimp in his mouth. And he goes, "Oh, yeah? Well," and he uses the jerk store line. "The jerk store called, and they ran out of you." And he's like full of excitement, right? Riley doesn't even skip a beat. He says, "Oh, what difference does it make? You're their all-time bestseller." And everybody roars. Everybody's laughing like crazy. Now, this is where it gets ugly. Because George is trapped. He's flying all the way to Akron. He's beside himself. He looks so mad. And this evil thought comes into his mind. He says, "Oh, yeah? Well, I just slept with your wife." It's ugly. The head of Firestone stands up from that table, walks over to George, and puts his arm around him. He says, "His wife is in a coma." Of course, the next scene, George is trying to figure out how to come up with a coma insult as he's driving back to New York. Listen, it, this is so simple, but it's so true. When we are hurt, emotionally hurt, and if you're not sure that that really matters, you would have to argue with the gospel writer here, because he thinks it matters enough to give all of this attention to the moment where Jesus is being mocked by these soldiers. It matters. When we are hurt, all of us have a choice about how we respond. We do. George might have said and argued that he had no choice. He had to insult this guy back. But the truth is, he had a choice. And the truth is, every single time you become the object of someone else's cruelty, when they say something mean, when they hurt your feelings, when they do something that really makes you feel disrespected, you still have a choice. And the choice is how you respond. Now, I want you to look at another painting, and you can leave the lights on, Jared. I just want, this is also by the same artist, and it's Van Hanthorst. I'm not sure why the color's not working. It really troubles me because this is very important. Let's see. Wonderful. You'll see it better when we get the lights off. This artist, Van Hanthorst, he dedicated quite a bit of time to this painting. This is just the same scene from another angle. Don't leave it on. In this moment, this man here has a choice. Jesus had a choice in that moment. We might look at him with the soldiers and say, no, he doesn't have any choice. He's powerless. But do you know who Jesus Christ is in this very moment? Do you know who this man is here? They're making fun of him as if he were a king, but he is the real king. And we know this. The book of Matthew opens to tell us that this man, when he was born, was the king already. That's what was behind that beautiful scene we talked about at Christmas time when the Magi brought three gifts to Jesus. Do you remember those three gifts that they brought to him? Frankincense, gold, and myrrh. They symbolized his divinity, his mortality, but also his royalty. Already at his birth, he was the king. And in an ironic way, the three gifts that these men put in on this man to mock him also show what is true, even though they don't know it. And that is that he is the king. That in this moment, as he sits there with his head hung down, and is the subject of their abuse and mockery, he has all the power in the universe. Even here, it's true, what was true just an hour before when he was in the garden praying that night, that he could call down 12 legions of angels. That's 60,000 angels. That's 100 angels for every single soldier that Matthew tells us was in that room that night. He could have called all of those angels down. And Jesus in this moment could choose to exert his authority and power, and he could retaliate. But he doesn't. Why not? Listen, it's not because he's weak. It's because he's strong. It's not because he's pitiful. It's because he's mighty in his restraint. It's not because he doesn't have any control. He has all the control. The reason he doesn't retaliate is because he has true control. He has self-control. And you must hear me. It's simple, but it's true. If you and if I and if all of us together would be some light in this world, we also must learn self-control. And self-control in moments like this, where we become the objects of people's abuse or mockery, the objects of their disrespect, their insults. What is going on here in this moment is that Jesus is choosing not to respond. Now, he has an ultimate reason. I said last week in the sermon that I would get back to the reason that Jesus did not defend himself before Pilate. Do you remember I said that? I never got back to it in the sermon. There were two people who accosted me afterward. I ran. Lost sleep over it that night. Part of the reason he doesn't defend himself here, as in the rest of this narrative, is for this reason, that Jesus knows the plan of his life is going to end on a cross. And he's going there to redeem us. And he's going there for the sake of his enemies. Romans 5 tells us this. That he's dying for all of these folks who are hurting him. That's why he doesn't defend himself. That's one reason. There's another reason why he doesn't defend himself here. And it's very simple and it's very challenging. Here's the reason. You ready for this? He wanted to give an example to you and to me about what it means to be a true human being. Now, I want you to know this. I didn't come up with that. It's not my idea. If I had to say what was going on here, I probably would never dream that up because I'm too much like George Costanza. I want too bad to get back at people. I would never dream up this idea that that's what's going on here. It comes from a person called Peter. You know, you remember that name, Peter? That was the one we spent some time on a few weeks back, the disciple who denied Jesus. But he stuck around and he saw this scene. Peter actually knew what was going on when Jesus did this. And he wrote a letter to some churches that he was close to later on. Some of you might know that in the New Testament, there's a book called 1 Peter and 2 Peter. Some of you know those letters. Listen to what he wrote about this scene to a church. He put it before them as I am talking about it with you tonight. And this is what he wrote. Listen, Christ suffered for you, leaving you an example so that you should follow in his footsteps. When he was abused, he did not return abuse. When he suffered, he did not threaten. That's 1 Peter 2, verses 21 to 25. Did you hear that? He left us an example so that we should follow in his steps. He goes on later to say this, do not repay evil for evil or abuse for abuse, but on the contrary, repay with a blessing. It is for this that you were called. That's 1 Peter 3, 9 through 12. The message of that is very simple to read and even to hear, but it's difficult to put into practice. This man here, Jesus, chose not to retaliate, and in so doing, he gave an example to you and to me so that we would follow in his footsteps. And the question that each of us must answer as individuals and that we must all answer as a church together is this. Will we follow in his footsteps in this way, or will we follow in the world's footsteps? Which is a very simple question. Will we retaliate when we're abused or not? Now, I want you to think of this practically, and I want you to consider your own life for a moment. All of us have some relationships that are more challenging in this regard than others. And I want you to consider, really, yourself now. Maybe you have a spouse who knows one of the things that you're personally very insecure about, and he takes advantage of that always to have the upper hand on you. And he says things that are mean. And you know, as soon as you hear it, that you could say something mean back because you know some of his weaknesses. If you will follow Jesus' footsteps, you will keep silent. Or maybe it's your group of friends that are so challenging for you. Maybe they're the sort that gossips all the time. And you're with them and they begin to tell you that one of the friends who's not there has been talking cruel about you. And as soon as you hear it, you know in your head that you have some ugly secrets about that person that you could bring up in that moment. And if you did, you would ruin them socially. Keep your mouth closed. Or how about this one? Maybe there's another church in the area that you hear has been talking ill of Orb. Incidentally, this is not imaginary. This has happened in the past, and it will happen again in the future. And you hear this, and the question that you must answer and that all of us must answer is how will we respond? What if there is another church that doesn't know us and says awful things? How will we respond? The choice for us is either our own steps to retaliate, say all nasty things back, or to follow the master here and to keep silent. And this is what I will tell you. If we as individuals or as a church, if we will have any impact in this dark world of ours, either in relation to the individuals that we're close to and we work with each other, or as a church in relation to other churches and other people in this area, if we will have any impact, it will come when we learn to imitate Jesus here and to choose not to retaliate, to not give evil for evil, and not to return abuse with abuse, but instead to return abuse to give blessing back like Jesus did. Is this something that we can do? The answer is absolutely yes. I know it is true that it's possible, and I'll tell you why I know that. On October 6th, in 2006, there was a gunman named Charles Roberts who entered the one-room Amish schoolhouse in the Old Order Amish community of Nickel Mines in Lancaster County, Pennsylvania. Do you remember this? That man shot and killed 5 girls who were between the ages of 6 and 13, and then he killed himself. The response of the Amish community was their choice. They had the opportunity to decide how to respond. On the day of the shooting, a grandfather of one of the murdered Amish girls was heard warning some young relatives not to hate the killer. And he said, and this is a quote, "We must not think evil of this man." Jack Meyer, a member of the Brethren community living near the Amish in Lancaster County, this is how he explained it. "I don't think there's anybody here that wants to do anything but forgive. And not only reach out to those who have suffered a loss, but in that way to reach out to the family of the man who committed these acts." An Amish neighbor comforted the Roberts family for hours after the shooting and extended forgiveness to them. Amish community members visited and comforted Roberts' widow. That's the man who killed himself and all of these children. The community went to his widow and comforted her. One Amish man held the murderer's sobbing father in his arms, reportedly for as long as an hour, to comfort him. They set up a charitable fund for the family of the shooter. 30 members of that community went to his funeral, and the widow was actually invited to the funeral of one of the children who was killed. Now, this is a letter, a public letter that was written by the widow of the murderer. "Your love for our family has helped to provide the healing we so desperately need. Gifts you've given have touched our hearts in a way no words can describe. Your compassion has reached beyond our family, beyond our community, and is changing our world." Now, she said that it was changing her and her family, but she also claimed that it was changing the world. And do you know, this is how I know about this. I didn't have a TV at the time, and I didn't know what had happened. I was in Starbucks a few days later. There's a guy who always sits there, and he's always reading Eastern philosophy. And he's a good man. He knows that I'm a Christian. He's always seen me reading my Bible. We've never talked about faith before this moment. But he approached me, and he said, "Christian," this is his question, "what do you know about the Amish community and the Brethren Church?" And then he asked me this, "Why is their faith so different than normal Christians?" I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "Why were they so quick to forgive? How is their Christianity different than every other Christian group that I know about?" Their choice, the choice that that community made was enormous. And when you put it beside the choices that you and I have to make about whether to retaliate or not, our choices seem petty, don't they? But I want you to understand this. They will not, on their own, they will not amount to much. But even the smallest bit of light is not overcome by the darkness. Which means for you, the moment that you are home and you're with a friend or your spouse and you have the opportunity either to respond by retaliating and giving evil for evil, but instead you choose not to, you bring a little light. And it's not light that is yours, but it is light that comes from the true light of the world, which is Jesus Christ. It's very simple. When we walk in his way, we reflect his light. When we do that with each other, we bring light instead of darkness. When we do that as a church, we become in this town not a light that shines our own light, but the light that reflects from the glory of the Lord who chose not to retaliate. And the call for us, very simply, in this text, is that we would learn to imitate this Lord and in that way, bear his light into the world. Now, Jared, I'd like you to turn off the lights because I want to show you one last thing. When I first saw this particular painting of von Hohenthorst's, I was fascinated by the light. He was one of the pioneers in his day of artificial light as a means of lighting up his paintings. You notice there's a candle, and the other one there's a candle as well. That's artificial light. He was one of the first people to really begin doing this. And when I saw this painting, I was struck by the fact that at the very center of the painting is the candle. Do you see it there? Right in the middle. And I looked at it for a little while, this painting, and I noticed, I had a hunch. I noticed that, and it's a little tough to see on the screen because it's blurry, but that the candle, which is, you would guess, the source of light in this painting, is actually, I'm not sure that it is actually the source of light. Look at it. Here's what I did. I got the picture into my, my fancy computer. And I changed the contrast. And watch, now, I just changed the contrast levels. And then after changing the contrast levels, there's these things you can do with images. I narrowed the range that of colors that were to be allowed, and it erased a lot of the dimmer colors in the painting, and this is what was left. These are sort of the brightest bits of the painting. And then I jacked the contrast up again. So it just left a few narrow bits of color range and really brought the contrast. And the next thing I did was I removed from the painting all of the light that was on the minor figures, these two men here, the one bowing and the one up in the corner. And that leaves this man who's holding the candle and Jesus. And now I want you to look with your eyes and tell me, is the candle the source of light in this painting? It's not, is it? It's not the candle. It's so obvious because look how bright his shoulder is and how bright his hand is and his neck is. This man here is standing before the source of light. And I don't know if the artist intended this, but I want you to listen to the words with which the Gospel of John opens. This is the book that tells us about Jesus. Here's what it says in the beginning of the Gospel of John. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was in the beginning with God. This is the way that this gospel begins to tell us about Jesus. All things came into being through him. Without him, not one thing came into being. What has come into being in him was life, and the life was the light of all people. The light shines in the darkness, and the darkness did not overcome it. And in this moment of darkness, Jesus shines. Later on, listen to how Jesus puts it, and this is the words that come to you and me. The light has come into the world, and people loved darkness rather than light, because their deeds were evil. For all who do evil hate the light and do not come into the light, so that their deeds may be exposed. Do you see what this man is doing with his hands? He's not blocking his eyes from the candle. He's blocking his eyes from Jesus. And that's why the shadow falls across his face like that. And the question that this story puts before us is a simple one. The question is, will we continue like this man to hold our eyes, our hand between this Jesus and our eyes? Or will we remove our hands and let this light fall upon our eyes? The light that shows us the power in choosing not to retaliate when we're hurt. The power that comes in returning a blessing when we are the victims of evil. Will we take our hands away from our eyes and let the light of this man fall upon him? I pray that we will. And I know that we will only be able to do it when we entrust ourselves to the one who judges justly, and that is the Father of our Lord Jesus Christ. And that is what it says in Peter, is the reason that this man cannot return abuse for abuse, because he entrusted himself into the hands of the Father. And I'll tell you this, that the hands of the Father are trustworthy. Let's pray together.